Here's a look at our top stories this hour. Iran's president says an anti-Tehran resolution adopted by UN nuclear agency under U.S. pressure amid JCPOA revival talks was against the spirit of the deal. UK protesters outraged at high fuel prices blocked several motorways and roads, causing delays and disruption and creating chaos among commuters. Also, U.S. police confirmed that a suspect in the deadly 4th of July parade mass shooting near the city of Chicago has been taken into custody. Thank you for joining us. Iran's president calls irresponsible a recent resolution by the Board of Governors of the International Atomic Energy Agency on Iran's nuclear program. Ebrahim Raisi says the move violates the spirit of negotiations that are ongoing to revive the 2015 deal. Raisi made the remarks while receiving the credentials of the new ambassador of Switzerland. He said the U.S. needs to decide on how to abide by the deal and its obligations. Raisi stressed that Western countries should also take into account that their hostile policies would not deter Iran from its developmental projects. He was reacting to an anti-Iran motion proposed by the U.S. and its three European allies at the IAEA's high-level meeting in June. The Iranian president also underlined that the Islamic Republic is ready to expand ties with all countries, including Switzerland. For her part, new Swiss envoy Nadine Olivier Ray noted that Bern and Tehran have had good relations in political, cultural, and economic fields for more than a century. Iran's president says the sky is the limit when it comes to the enhancement of ties with Baku, stressing that this can lead to effective regional cooperation. In a meeting with a visiting Azeri foreign minister, Ebrahim Raisi also called for more public travels between the two countries. He said greater interaction between the people of the two countries will also consolidate friendly ties between the nations. Jehun Bayramov, for his part, said the bilateral trade volume has increased considerably over the past 17 months. He also echoed Iran's long-standing position that regional issues should be resolved by the countries in the region without foreign interference. Bayramov also met with his Iranian counterpart earlier in the day. Hossein Amir Abdullahian called for a peaceful resolution of the conflict between Azerbaijan and Armenia over the Nagorno-Karabakh region, declaring Iran's readiness to help. Tehran has held the fourth International Conference on American Human Rights. The event reviewed the human rights situation worldwide and its challenges as a result of the U.S. policies. A senior Iranian official told the meeting the U.S. is in no position to talk human rights. Our Tehran correspondent Salman Gujuri reports.
Tehran has organized the fourth edition of its International Conference on American Human Rights. The conference was attended by Iranian officials, experts, and the youth from over 50 countries. The event was held on the occasion of the American Human Rights Week in Iran. It reviewed the human rights situation worldwide and its challenges as a result of the United States' double standard policies. Addressing the event, Secretary of Iran's High Council for Human Rights, Kazem Gharibabadi, said the U.S. is in no position to talk about human rights, given its widespread violations.
One can confidently claim that there is no nation in today's world that has not tasted the bitter taste of the American version of human rights. The U.S. administration should be held responsible to the oppressed peoples who have lost their lives as a result of terrorism, sanctions, aggression, and occupation.
Iranian officials and experts believe that the gravest violation that can be committed against human rights is to politicize the issue, and this is exactly what the U.S. has done. A senior Iranian diplomat says human rights are turned into a pretext and a tool for the expansion and institutionalization of the predominance of American unilateralism.
Today, human rights are turned into a pretext and a tool for expansion and institutionalization of the predominance of American unilateralism. Sanctions and terrorism are the main pillars of the American version of human rights. If they are robbed of these two pillars, they may not be able to continue their dominance and plots.
Analysts believe that the unilateral U.S. sanctions are a means of collective punishment of all people, without any exception. Here in Iran, people believe that the title American Human Rights Week seeks to condemn Washington's double standard policies with regard to human rights and reveal this very reality to the world. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
Shelling by Ukrainian forces has killed at least two people in the eastern Donetsk region, which is now the new epicenter of the war between Kiev and Moscow. According to pro-Russia forces, five civilians were killed and 13 others wounded in Ukrainian shelling of the region a day earlier. Ukrainian officials accused Russian forces of launching similar deadly attacks on civilians. The governor of the Donetsk region said on Sunday that seven civilians were killed and at least 20 others injured as a result of Russian shelling. Russian forces captured the neighboring Luhansk region over the weekend, marking a significant milestone for Moscow in its war in Ukraine. The Russian president hailed what he described as the liberation of the region, ordering his forces to continue advancing towards the western parts of the Donetsk region. Pro-Russia forces in Ukraine already controlled large parts of the Luhansk and Donetsk regions, which formed Donbass before the war broke out between Moscow and Kiev in late February. The head of the Umbrella Organization for Trade Unions in Germany warns that natural gas supply cuts from Russia can lead to the collapse of entire industries. Yasmin Fahimi from the German Federation of Trade Unions said the country's aluminum, gas or glass, and chemical industries are in danger in case of a halt to Russian gas. She stressed that such a collapse would have massive consequences for the economy and jobs in Germany. She added the energy crisis is already driving inflation to record highs. Europe's largest economy relies on Russia for 35% of its natural gas needs. Germany has already triggered the second stage of a three-phase gas emergency plan. Meanwhile, Russia has reduced gas flow via the Nord Stream pipeline by 60%. Moscow says it has taken the move as Western sanctions are hampering the service of its equipment. Serious disruptions across the UK as protesters target motorways and demonstrations over rising fuel prices. Roads in various parts of the country have seen traffic jams as protesters take action and call for cuts in fuel tax. Saeed Puriza reports from London.
Give us cheaper fuel or this is what you're gonna get. Protesters blocking lanes and taking part in slowdowns on busy roads across the UK.
Give us our country back!
Organized on social media by Fuel Price Stand Against Tax, they're demanding deeper cuts in fuel duty. Chancellor Rishi Sunak announced a 5p cut in March, but that has not meant much at the forecourts.
Fuel prices in the UK have hit record highs since the beginning of the year. Only a few months ago, it would have cost roughly $90 to fill up, let's say, a 50-litre tank. But now it'll cost $30 more to fill up that same tank.
And that has put the squeeze on the finances of people. Some have had to quit their jobs because they couldn't afford the commute anymore. Businesses, too, are feeling the pinch at the pump and are passing the extra costs onto the consumers, worsening the cost of living crisis.
Worst of all, the poorest are suffering the most. You can't just switch off your power, you can't switch off your car, you can't switch off your central heating. And when winter comes, people will freeze. All of that, a direct consequence of this government's failure to have a joined-up energy policy, and we are literally paying the consequences.
Among the biggest factors contributing to the fuel price hikes, the UK's green energy policy and Western sanctions on Russian energy exports in the wake of the Ukraine war, sanctions that the UK government was among the first to impose.
The sanctions imposed upon Russia for political reasons have clearly pushed up the energy costs. But secondly, and even more importantly, Britain has an idiotic environmental policy where they import the very fossil fuels that they depend on, even though under our feet there are £1 trillion worth of gas, and in the North Sea there are billions of pounds worth of oil.
Prime Minister Boris Johnson has hinted at a rise in UK oil and gas output, but critics say it would have little effect on consumer bills. And as long as the UK, along with its Western allies, fans the flames of the war in Ukraine, scenes like this may well become more frequent. Saeed Puriza, London.
U.S. police have captured a suspect in connection with a deadly 4th of July parade mass shooting in a suburb of Chicago. Police say 22-year-old Robert Cremo was arrested following a brief car chase more than 8 hours after the shooting. Six people were killed and over 36 others were wounded when a man with a high-powered rifle opened fire from a rooftop at the Independence Day parade. This was the latest mass shooting in the U.S. where gun violence is a chronic issue. A massacre in late May killed 19 school children and 2 teachers at an elementary school in Uvalde, Texas. That came just days after an attack that killed 10 people at a grocery store in Buffalo, New York. Well, the latest shooting comes just days after the U.S. Congress passed the first major gun reforms in 3 decades. However, as our correspondent Colin Campbell tells us from Washington, the legislation has clearly failed to stop the gun violence. Take a listen.
Well, we do know that several people have already been killed and several more injured. And this is just another tragic day when it comes to gun violence in America, when it comes to mass shootings in America, particularly on a day that many are supposed to be celebrating their independence. When it comes to gun legislation, we did see some gun legislation passed not too long ago, and this was the most that had passed since the Trump administration when it came to bump stocks, and then several years before that, probably nothing major since the assault weapons ban during, I believe, the Clinton administration. With the latest legislation that was passed into law, we saw red flag laws being implemented. Those who might have been arrested for violence or abuse, they would definitely have to go through a number of checks and balances or even be disallowed from even ever owning a gun. They raised the legal age for trying to buy an assault rifle. They raised that age. There was money allocated for mental health awareness and mental health help for those who need it. So this was probably the most serious and comprehensive gun reform, if one could call it that, we've had in several years. Many have said that it has fallen short, however, of really doing anything profound when it comes to gun access and limiting the amount of guns people can have or the amount of ammunition that people could have. So would this legislation have stopped something like this? I think we have the answer right here, that this incident still occurred despite legislation being passed. So again, this may have fallen short of doing anything serious and profound in the way that gun violence has just proliferated in the United States, contributing to numerous mass shootings throughout the year, like we've had today.
4 migrants seeking to enter the U.S. crossing the country's southern frontier can be a deadly journey. A new study describes the U.S.-Mexico border as the world's deadliest migration land route. The study was published by the International Organization for Migration. It records over 1,000 deaths during migration in the Americas in 2021, with the U.S.-Mexico border accounting for over 700 deaths. The figure is much higher than in any preceding year. The perils of land crossing into the U.S. were brought to the fore once again after the discovery of a tractor trailer in Texas containing the dead bodies of 46 migrants. The victims were Mexican, Guatemalan, and Honduran nationals. U.S. Border Patrol officers say around 240,000 migrants tried to enter the country via its southern borders in June alone. Russia has slammed as unacceptable the recent strikes on Syria that have been blamed on Israel, calling for an unconditional cessation of the attacks. The Russian Foreign Ministry has strongly condemned the attacks as irresponsible actions that violate Syria's sovereignty. Moscow says such aggressions also constitute a breach of international law. On the 2nd of July, Israel carried out fresh airstrikes in the Arab country. Damascus said Israel fired several missiles from the Mediterranean west of the Lebanese city of Tripoli, targeting Syria's port city of Tartus. According to Syrian officials, at least 2 civilians were injured in the attack. The strike also caused some material damage. That was the latest in a spate of Israeli strikes against Syria. Damascus has time and again denounced Israel's acts of aggression and filed official complaints with the UN and other international bodies. Sudan's coup leader is signaling a compromise after months of unrest. Abdel Fattah al-Burhan says the army would make way for civilian rule by withdrawing from national talks mediated by the UN and regional blocs.
It was decided, first, the non-participation of the military institution in the current negotiations, which are facilitated by the tripartite mechanism, to make room for political and revolutionary forces and other national factions to form a civilian government of independent national competencies.
Speaking in a televised address, Burhan said the armed forces will not hamper a democratic transition. He added that the military is committed to working towards elections in which the Sudanese people will be able to choose their own government. Burhan also promised the dissolution of the Sovereign Council after the formation of a new government. The council was formed under a power-sharing agreement between the army and civilians in 2019. Burhan's remarks come after a week of deadly anti-coup protests. Several people have lost their lives since Thursday, bringing to 114 the total number of protesters killed while demanding civilian rule. Sudan witnessed months-long unrest following the ouster of former President Omar al-Bashir. The subsequent power-sharing deal between the military and civilians was scrapped in a coup in October 2021. The U.S. State Department says the Israeli military gunfire was likely responsible for the killing of veteran Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Aghla in May. The department, however, says it has found no reason to believe that the shooting was intentional. It also claims that investigators could not reach a definitive conclusion regarding the origin of the bullet that killed the journalist. The department says the bullet was badly damaged and that prevented a clear conclusion. A member of the Palestine Liberation Organization has accused Washington of trying to protect Tel Aviv. On Saturday, the Palestinian Authority agreed to transfer the bullet that killed the Al Jazeera reporter to the Americans for examination. However, a day later, an Israeli military spokesman said Israel would conduct the test under American observation. Abu Aghla was killed on May 11 while covering an Israeli army raid in the city of Jenin.
Well, that's your world news for now. Stay tuned.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains. Close up, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. Oh, it's a few minutes to the call to prayer, and I'm late. You know, my grandma and I are going to perform Maghrib and Isha prayers in a beautiful mosque in our neighborhood. My prayers mat is ready. And this is my chador for prayers. I have to rush. Before I forget, tomorrow I'll make a trip to Isfahan in order to take a tour to one of the invaluable treasures of Iran, the Jame Mosque of Isfahan. The Jame Mosque of Isfahan, which is also known as the Jame Mosque of Atiq or the Friday Mosque of Isfahan, is one of the historical monuments of the city of Isfahan, which dates back to the 2nd century AH. However, the mosque is older than the date cited, and archaeologists have found relics dating back to the Sasanid era. The discovery of one pillar, with the decorations which date back to the Sasanid era, located in the northern part of the mosque, represents the fact that this monument dates back to the pre-Islamic era. In fact, the Jame Mosque of Isfahan was formed during 2,000 years and has been finally transformed into the current shape. The Jame Mosque of Isfahan is a museum for itself because inside it you can find monuments dating back to the Sasanid, Abbasid, Daylamite, Buyid, Seljuqid, Safavid, and Qajarid dynasties. The most important development projects of this mosque was done during the Buyid dynasty and after that during the Safavid era. The current appearance of the mosque, mostly related to its development, was done during the Seljuqid era. However, the repairs and attachments were done later during other historical eras, particularly during the Safavid era. The Jame Mosque of Isfahan is located in the old part of the city of Isfahan. I am now in Allame Majlisi Street. I have to walk a few blocks to reach the mosque. By the way, the mausoleum of Allame Majlisi, who was one of the prominent ulema of the Safavid era, is situated in the area of the mosque. That is why this street is called Allame Majlisi. And I am now in the area of the Jame Mosque of Isfahan. Oh, these beautiful blue and azure tiles make one quite excited, as if the sky has come down. The design of this mosque is for Ivan design. This design is completely Iranian. The name of these beautiful Ivans are as follows. Sofeye Sahib in the south, Sofeye Darvish in the north, Sofeye Ustad in the west, and Sofeye Shagird in the east. I'll get closer to see the details. I am now in the southern Ivan of the mosque, just beneath the dome and the 40 pillars around. This magnificent dome is made of bricks and plaster and dates back to the Seljuqid era. It's true, they say that the Jame Mosque of Isfahan and the areas around tell us the story of people who used to live in the era of Seljuqids. Thank you. I am now in Sofie Shagird. This Ivan doesn't have tile work decorations and instead is adorned by brickmate Mogarnas. Oh my god, these Mogarnas works are a masterpiece. In this Ivan, there is a piece of rich integrated marble stone with inscriptions around and above it. I am now in the northern part of Ostad Ivan. Here there is a small shabistan which has the most beautiful plasterwork mehrab in the world. This mehrab, which is the masterpiece of Iranian art, shines like a gem. In order to protect this mehrab, it is put in a glass guard. Though, from the distance I am standing, the beauties of this mehrab is completely visible. The Jame Mosque of Isfahan is very beautiful and wonderful. Be sure that later during this series, I'll come back to this mosque in order to talk about the details of the mosque for you. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Food for thought. Hello everyone, and let us ponder a wise saying from the command of the faithful and the leader of the pious, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him. The best friend is good mannerism. It is the title of the record book of the believers.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, good manner and avoiding flattery. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of good manner and avoiding flattery. Unfortunately, in today's world, we see that in the societies, the flattery is being known as having a good manner. And this is something bad. It's a bad characteristics that some people have. And on the other hand, in the society, especially in the Western society, they name it as PR or personal relation. They say it is a skill that a person has. And this bad ethical thing is being known as good in some societies, which is not a good thing. We must avoid flattery because when a person sees someone who can give him a favor, or maybe there is an important person in the society, we see there are many people who praise such a person, who try to be a good person, who show themselves, who basically are trying to show that they are the good people, but they are not actually. Why? Because when we see them with other people, with ordinary people, we don't see such manner, we don't observe such manner in them when they are with the ordinary people. And this is the sign of knowing whether a person is performing flattery or not. A person who is praising fakely and who do not pay attention to the people who are lower in class, and the one who never respect others, the one who are equal to them, the one who has a lower class, if he is not respecting them, then obviously this is something which is not known as being a good manner. Rather, it is a flattery that a person is performing. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of good manner and avoiding flattery. It is very important when we talk about the good manner, we must avoid flattery. And this is from the limits of the good manner, that we avoid all kinds of flattery. We deal with the people the way they are. And if we are having a good manner, and if we are dealing with people with kindness, it should be for all kinds of people. Rather they are rich, rather they are same in the class, or maybe they're from a lower class, maybe the people are poor, if there is a needy. So all the time when I'm dealing with such people, I'm dealing in a good manner. I'm dealing with them with a good behavior. I'm being kind towards all these people in the same way. And this shows that this good manner is a permanent characteristic in myself. And that's what I need to strive for. Islam talks about such thing. On the other hand, we have the narration from the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, where he says that إِذَا مُدِحَ الْفَاجِرُ, if someone praises a transgressor, if someone praises someone because of his wealth, اِهْتَزَّ الْعَرْشُ وَغَذِبَ الرَّبِ, the arsh, it shakens. And on the other hand, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, or our Lord, become angry upon us. Why? Because this is something which is bad in the Islamic teachings. Islam does not like flattery characteristics of the people. This way of dealing with the people. Islam talks about good manner. Islam talks about husne khulq, which is a good manner, and having this with all kinds of people, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
News, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With the light.
A man in the city of Soran in Iraq's autonomous Kurdistan region has become a local celebrity for a rather peculiar feature on his face. Hussein Abdullah Ahmed is famous for a record-breaking length of his mustache. Ahmed has been going by the name Mr. Mustache for decades now. His mustache has reached the length of 2.4 meters, making him a well-known man in the city he hails from. His son says, however, that his father's unusual feature is nothing new for him.
I've always known my father likes this since I was born. Although there were times when I had seen his mustache short, my dad is famous for his mustache, and we're proud of him.
Ahmed admits his mustache troubles him while working on the farm or trying to sleep. But to avoid the trouble, he either ties it from behind or stuffs it under his clothes. The 73-year-old man is not planning to get rid of his facial hair, which he hasn't trimmed since 1994. He seems to be enjoying the ride of fame as people stop him on the streets to take selfies with him.
In Brazil, a 100-year-old man has broken the world record for the longest spell working at a single company. Walter Orthman has entered the Guinness World Record books for working at the same fabric company for an astonishing period of 84 years. He started on the factory floor before moving into administration and later on into the sales management. Despite his extraordinary accomplishment, Orthman's advice for those looking for a long and fulfilling professional life is surprisingly routine.
You have to like to work. I started to work with that willingness and fighting spirit. You also have to start working on something you like to do. You can't just do any job to say that you're working. That doesn't work. You're not going to be able to stand it. You have to look for a job that you like to do. And there, you won't even feel the time passing. That's what happened with me. I started working here, and I liked it. I worked my way up from point to point until I got to the position I'm in today.
Ortman says his secret to a long life and breaking the record is having a healthy lifestyle and staying away from junk food. He says he avoids sugar and salt as much as possible and tries to keep a diet that is healthy for the mind and soul. In order to stay sharp, Ortman says he does stretches and maintains physical activity. A bridge too scary for many, but just the right place for those with a head for heights. Vietnam has opened the world's longest glass bottom bridge to the public.
The now recorded longest glass bottom cliffside pathway, and it's spectacular. The engineering required to build that into the side of a cliff, but maintain all the features of nature, the greenery, the rock, has been an amazing project, very successful, and I think it will attract a lot of tourists.
The White Dragon Suspension Bridge fittingly opened with a dragon dance. The structure is longer than the previous record holder in China and has two sections. One stretches over 630 meters between two mountains, while the other runs around a cliffside. Visitors can look straight down at the valley 150 meters below. The structure is safe and made from three layers of 40 millimeter tempered glass. With soaring fuel prices, the importance of solar-powered vehicles is on the rise. Now a Kashmiri math teacher has gone viral for creating a car powered by solar energy. The car, which is fully covered with solar panels, uses sunlight to charge its battery. The vehicle has a braking system that regenerates power to its batteries. The inventor of the car, Bilal Ahmed, says he has spent about $19,000 for his project and has not used external funds.
It was my dream to invent a solar car for the people of Kashmir. It took me 13 years to complete my dream. I'm thankful to the Almighty I succeeded in this project.
Bilal says he has built the car manually and without any automation. He hopes to put his fully automatic car into mass production to create jobs for local people.
Just like humans and animals, plants get sick too. But what do you do with an ill plant? An Indian man has found an answer to that. He has opened an emergency room only for plants in Amritsar, a city in India's Punjab state. A tax officer and his wife have set up the Pushpa Tree and Plant Hospital. In Pushpa, they have expert biologists and tree lovers on hand to provide the so-called sick patients with their essential nutrients. The clinic aims to treat any and every disease and even has an emergency vehicle on call for unhealthy trees around the city. The officer's wife says, just as we humans bleed, breathe, and need cures, plants also bleed, breathe, and need cures.
We provide approximately 32 various services for plants and trees, like if there's a nail in the tree, how to take out that nail. Deep poisoning of the trees. Yes, you heard it right. There are people who poison the trees. Again, if the tree is not bearing fruits, there's an attack of mealybugs or another insects. That's also cured here. If the trees or plants are dying and you're unable to take care of them, even that problem is sorted out.
Only a month into the hospital's operation, Rohit Mehra and his team of 20 volunteers have already received more than 300 queries. The hospital is also completely free of charge.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Staff at the National Zoo of Cuba in the capital city of Havana are celebrating a new arrival of a rare baby white rhinoceros. The little calf, named Al, quickly became popular among other animals in the park after he was born. He is part of a conservation program that will add to a gene bank for future breeding. Al is the second white rhinoceros to be born in captivity in 18 years. The park is home to 8 white rhinos and 4 black ones. Zoo staff say the park has one of the largest exhibits of this mammal among zoos in Latin America. White rhinos are endangered species and their population has dwindled due to illegal poaching and environmental destruction.
Persian fallow deer is a unique but endangered species known for its sleek and spotted body. In this report, our correspondent Youssef Jalali takes us on a quick tour around one of the world's few protected shelters of Persian fallow deer in Iran's city of Sari.
We had to keep quiet and avoid making any sounds to film them, as they are shy and swift, and the slightest sound could send them sprinting and jumping away. Over 60 Persian fallow deer roam in Dashtanaz Wildlife Refuge in Iran's northern city of Sari. The endangered species is carefully protected here to be safe from predators and poachers.
The Persian fallow deer is native to Iran's Khuzestan province, but due to loss of habitat and threats posed to them by predators such as jackals and wild cats, they are endangered and need to be protected in semi-natural refuges like this one.
Persian fallow deer are mainly indigenous to open woodland areas spanning from East Mediterranean coasts to West and Southwest Iran. By 1875, they had gone extinct in all of their main habitats, except in southwest Iran. After a captive breeding program, the population has rebounded from only a handful of deer in the 1960s to over 200 individuals in Iran.
Dashtinaz Wildlife Refuge is a 55 hectares wide. It was introduced in 1962 as a shelter for the Persian fallow deer when the species was on the brink of extinction. At that time, five deer were captured and translocated to this refuge. Over the past six decades, their number have been multiplied through captive breeding.
The Persian fallow deer is a rare ruminant mammal belonging to the family Cervidae. They're physically larger than other fallow deer, and their antlers are bigger and less palmate. Their special beauty has turned this sanctuary into a hot tourist attraction in Iran's north.
This sanctuary is a tourist destination for visitors who would like to see the Hyrkanian forests in Iran's north and at the same time enjoy the wildlife and learn about efforts made to save the Persian fallow deer from extinction.
In 2015, the Persian fallow deer was registered in the IUCN Red List of Threatened Species. Dashtinaz authorities hope through continued captive breeding, the population of these special creatures will soon reach the desired number, and hopefully they will be reintroduced to their natural habitat in southwest Iran.
While they live far from their original habitat, these alluring creatures feel at home here, where they will be safe from the dangers lurking outside, which may lead to their extinction. So here, Persian fallow deer continue to embellish the nature and charm visitors with their beauty. Yusuf Jalali from Dashtinaz Wildlife Refuge in Sari.
Catching fish makes you forget even the most complex problems. But think the moment you catch the strangest one. Well, a Cambodian fisherman has caught what researchers say is the world's biggest freshwater fish ever recorded. The giant fish, which weighs around 300 kilograms and 4 meters long, was caught last week from the Mekong River. The female stingray was released back into water after being electronically tagged to allow scientists to monitor her movement and behavior. The fish was named Barami, meaning full moon in the Khmer language. An American fish biologist, Dana Lee, says the data collected from Barami can help protect the species and its habitat.
We got a call this morning at breakfast that they had caught a giant stingray here at Coprea. So we dropped everything. People came up from Phnom Penh, and we're here now just at sunset. Just tagged the giant, 330-kilogram giant stingray here in the Mekong River, and released it here right at sunset.
The stingray dethrones the former record holder, a 290-kilogram catfish found in northern Thailand in 2005. More than 1,000 species live in the Mekong River. The famous waterway originates in China and twists south through parts of Thailand, Laos, Myanmar, Cambodia, and Vietnam. Scientists have warned that plastic waste and dam threaten wildlife even in the deepest stretches of the Mekong.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
On Thursday, 30th of June, the U.S. Supreme Court's conservative majority, with its 6-3 ruling in the case of West Virginia versus the Environmental Protection Agency, curtailed the power of the agency to protect the environment, and specifically to require the reductions in emissions that are urgently necessary to limit global warming. The article you're about to hear has been written by the editorial board of the New York Times. The piece has been published in the opinion section of the newspaper and is titled, "The Supreme Court Sabotages Efforts to Protect Public Health and Safety." On Thursday, 30th of June, the U.S. Supreme Court's conservative majority, with its 6-3 ruling in the case of West Virginia versus the Environmental Protection Agency, curtailed the power of the agency to protect the environment, and specifically to require the reductions in carbon emissions that are urgently necessary to limit global warming. The court's ruling constrains any effort to lighten restrictions on carbon dioxide emissions from power plants. It also threatens the Biden administration's ability to impose new limits on tailpipe emissions from cars and trucks and on methane emissions from oil and gas facilities. As the three members of the court's liberal minority wrote in a stinging dissent, the majority's decision strips the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, of the power to respond to the most pressing environmental challenges of our times. The Biden administration, already struggling to persuade Congress to invest in renewable energy and compelled by the Russia-Ukraine conflict to push for increased production of fossil fuels, once again finds its ambitious goals of confronting climate change slipping beyond reach. The court's adversarial posture means the Biden administration must double down on its efforts to win congressional support for its spending plans. President Joe Biden and Democratic leaders should also press to pass legislation clarifying the Environmental Protection Agency's authority to regulate emissions. Thursday, 30th of June's ruling also has consequences far beyond environmental regulations. It threatens the ability of federal agencies to issue rules of any kind, including the regulations that ensure the safety of food, the safety of medicines and other consumer products, that protect workers from injuries and that prevent financial panics. In 1984, an earlier generation of conservative Supreme Court justices formalized a doctrine of deference to the judgment of regulatory agencies, modestly concluding that judges were neither experts nor elected officials, and therefore ought to leave such decisions in other hands. In Thursday's decision, the Supreme Court asserted that the policy of deference applies only to supposedly unimportant regulations. When it comes to major questions of regulatory policy, the court said, it would not hesitate to second-guess regulators and to strike rules that it decides did not have a clear congressional warrant. The decision amounts to a warning shot across the bow of the administrative state. The court's current conservative majority, engaged in a counter-revolution against the norms of American society, is seeking to curtail the efforts of federal regulators to protect the public's health and safety. The court already invoked a similar logic during the COVID pandemic to strike down workplace COVID testing requirements and a federal moratorium on evictions. And by refraining from defining a threshold for what constitutes a major question, the court is leaving a sword hanging over every new rule. The West Virginia case has its origins in 2015, when the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, imposed new limits on carbon dioxide emissions from coal-fired power plants. The EPA determined that it was impossible for those plants to reduce emissions to what it regarded as a safe level while producing the same amount of electricity. Burning coal is simply too dirty. Accordingly, it directed companies to cut carbon emissions by reducing output or by shifting to other forms of power generation. The rule never took effect. The court stayed its implementation in 2016, and the Trump administration withdrew it in 2019. But the litigants, including the states of West Virginia and North Dakota, and a pair of coal companies, pressed ahead with a lawsuit to make sure the rule stayed dead. Chief Justice John Roberts, writing for the majority, agreed with their claim that the Environmental Protection Agency did not have the authority to require companies to shift resources to other kinds of power generation. Chief Justice John Roberts wrote that the court's long-standing policy in such cases of deference to the agency's own assessment of its authority did not apply because the stakes were too high. It is a theory long championed by Chief Justice Neil Gorsuch, who explained in a concurring opinion that administrative agencies must be able to point to clear congressional authorization when they claim the power to make decisions of vast economic and political significance. The Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, clearly has the legal authority to set an acceptable standard for carbon emissions, in this case of carbon dioxide, and then to impose restrictions on emitters, in this case coal-fired power plants. The court did not contest these facts. Instead, it ruled that the Clean Air Act does not provide the Environmental Protection Agency with sufficient authority to achieve those emissions standards. Chief Justice John Roberts described this conclusion as a defense of congressional authority, an assertion of the primacy of elected officials. But constraining the power of regulatory agencies should not be understood as a shift in the locus of decision-making. Rather, it effectively prevents good decisions from being made. Congress has decided, and with good reason, that regulatory agencies staffed by experts are the best available mechanism for a representative democracy to make decisions in areas of technical complexity. The Environmental Protection Agency is the entity that Congress relies upon to figure out how clean the air should be and how to get there. Asserting that